Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Let's go over to our conference phone and continue with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds on Earth Day as a special, Rising Up, Moving Towards an Earth Democracy that is based upon the principles of justice, sustainability, and peace. We have two guests. My first guest is Dr. Vandana Shiva. She is an internationally renowned environmental and social activist and a leading pioneer behind India's ecological and ecofeminism movement. Dr. Shiva is the founder of a very important organization dedicated to the restoration of organic farming across India and the preservation of indigenous knowledge and culture. And for several decades, Vandana has fought for changes in agricultural practices and food security. She's traveled the world speaking on behalf of women's rights and against biopiracy and globalization and patenting of indigenous knowledge by large agriculture and pharmaceutical corporations. And her activist efforts have created grassroots organizations throughout the developing world to counter GMOs and empower women. And she's received numerous international awards, including the Alternative Nobel Prize, the Right Livelihood Award, and the UNEP's Global 500 Award and the UN's Earth Day International Award. And among her many books are Earth Democracy, Justice, Sustainability, and Peace. Most recently, Staying Alive, Women, Ecology, and Development. And her websites are Vandana Shiva, that's shiva.com, and Navadanya, navdanya.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be back on your show, Gary.
I'd like to begin with a quote from an ancient Indian text that you have referenced. It is from the Isha Upanishad, written approximately 2,500 years ago. Now, I find it rather remarkable because it is so relevant today and could be the words of any of today's critics against corporate capitalism and monetary greed. And it's an excellent description of what the UN would define as the definitive understanding of sustainability. The text says, quote, "A selfish man, overutilizing the resources of nature to satisfy his own ever-increasing needs, is nothing but a thief, because using resources beyond one's needs would result in the utilization of resources over which others have a right." Now, the Upanishads are spiritual texts, likely written by sages and yogis who seemingly removed themselves from the rigid structural Indian society at the time, and therefore they may have had a clear, objective perspective and deeper insights about the social and religious flaws at the time than rulers and citizens immersed in the status quo would have not observed. And this would be analogous to the close-mindedness of the majority of people living in industrialized capitalist societies who benefit from the system, but are too close-minded to observe the repercussions of their acts and our capitalist group think. And today, democracy is only for those who can afford it, who can buy it, who can reap the benefits of it. So it is a democracy based solely upon capital and material stuff, empty of essential universal values. And it is solely anthropogenic. And other species near Earth itself has no place at the table. The alternative you posit would be a democracy built upon the wisdom of the Earth and the universal values inherent in human nature. This is a spiritual vision. So please take your time and present the principles of an Earth democracy and juxtapose this with the faux or phony democracy promoted by neoliberal capitalist nations. The forum is yours.
Well, both the ancient Indian vision of Vasudeva Kutumbakam that the earth is a family, that the 300 species are your extended kin, is what informs the Isha Upanishad from where you quoted, because if there are 300 million species, then all of them have a right to their share of ecological space, their share of participating in ecological processes, supporting other lives and being supported in return. This is also the new learning we are getting from ecological science, whether it be the Gaia theory of James Lovelock or the self-organized sense of interdependence of the web of life. It's interesting that Gandhi distilled that Isha Upanishad and turned it into that phrase, the earth has enough for everyone's needs, but not for a few people's greed. And he said if there's one learning in the world on the basis of which humanity can shape its future in order to be just and sustainable at the same time, then this is it. So Gandhi was a very, very contemporary thinker of our times, of that ancient learning. And my book, Earth Democracy, is basically addressing the challenges now of the 21st century that we face, including the issue of phony democracy that you raised. When you think of the fact that not only was representative democracy not representing the rest of life, it stopped representing most human beings. It took such struggles of women to get a vote. And in some places, that's still not fully done. How many people are excluded from participation in that representation? And meantime, the neoliberal model of the economy, which reduces everything to a commodity, everything to a market and no other relationship except that which you can have through the global market, has exhausted the earth and is disposing of majority of human beings. When you look at the figures that are coming out, 62 men, the 62 richest men control as much as the wealth of 50% of humanity, and if these processes are allowed to continue, they're going to control 99% of the wealth of humanity. And I always say, how on earth did the Occupy movement come up with this figure that today amazing researchers are coming up with, and the trends, the empirical trends being released by financial institutions and banks are confirming this figure of the 1% and the 99%. Now, you have in addition to the fact that anyway representative democracy excluded large numbers, you have a Citizen United decision in the United States saying corporations are persons and their freedom of speech is stealing democracy. So you literally in the last 10 years we've seen representative democracy, thin as it was, shallow as it was, partial as it was, being totally dismembered. And instead of being of the people, by the people, for the people, it has become very, very nakedly of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. And the corporations themselves are fronts behind which are these super wealthy men and their investment fabrications. They're cooking up instruments. Look at what the derivatives and securities trade did with the real estate and housing and the entire 2008 collapse. But every instrument of the economy is being shaped so the wealthy can make money out of fictitious instruments and use that fictitious instrument to then take away the real resources of the people. My struggle in India has been to prevent the seed from becoming the property of Monsanto. And it's taken 30 years. It is literally 30 years of Navdanya starting this year. And we've created 120 community seed banks. We were saying the royalties Monsanto is extracting from peasants are immoral and unjust, because if we are an earth family, one member of a family doesn't say, I've invented you, you're my property, and I will take rents from every day of your life on earth. Exactly what Monsanto is doing with the seed. They have now got trapped. We have had 300,000 farm suicides, most of them because of indebtedness. Most of the suicides are in the cotton areas. 95% of the cotton is owned and controlled by Monsanto through these fabricated property rights, which is what led me to create Navzania. And now the government is saying, sorry, you looted us. You've looted our farmers. You have cheated. And we are going to put a price on the seed and a limit to how much you can collect in royalties. And their court cases, I'm intervening in many court cases, as I have done for the last 20 years. Water. You know, we are running out of water. As large part of central India, where most of the BT cotton is grown, where most of the suicides are, is now suffering from a severe water crisis. And water is being taken by train from North India, thousands of miles down to the southern peninsula. Soil. We've destroyed our soil. And this greedy economy where a few greedy men think they can predate on the planet are engaging in the most violent form of land grab, dispossessing tribals, using militarized forces, killing earth defenders, killing human rights defenders. And so we can see there are two clear paths to the future. One of violence, militarization, exclusion, and the 1% shooting and killing the 99% dead. The other is the 100% species, 300 million, 7 billion people working in nonviolent relationships of respect, sharing this planet with love and with care. And what I have found in my 4 decades of work of protecting the earth, defending the earth, fighting every violation that my life throws me into, we are finding that actually when we work for the earth and in service of the earth, she gives us much more. We produce more food than all the industrial agriculture, than all of the GMO myths. We can feed 2 times the planet by protecting every pollinator, every soil organism, because they are co-creators for our food system. And the same goes with climate change. The minute you realize we have to become part of the carbon cycle, instead of pumping gases based on fossil fuels, whether it's direct carbon dioxide or fossil fuels burnt up to make nitrogen fertilizers emitting nitrogen oxides, or imprisoning animals in big giant factory farms and having methane emissions, all of that is 50% of the climate problem. You become nonviolent in your farming, you can pull out that excess carbon and you stop the emissions. In a nonviolent agriculture that's also protecting our health, an area that you dedicate so much of your time to, that is what will help us bring health back to this planet, to this beloved earth of ours. And the actions are the same. So this false idea of anthropocentrism to first banish the earth and all her living beings, and then to create structures, whether it was science and technology structures or economic models, to then say to improve growth, to have development, you've got to wipe out all other species, and finally wipe out most of humanity. That is such a false paradigm. It is time for us to celebrate this Earth Day, to say we will shape a worldview based on the Earth as a family. We will start practicing Earth democracy, which is both the democracy of all life as well as a democracy in everyday life. What you eat, how you relate to people, what you drink, every bit of it is an action for the Earth democracy, not waiting till 2017 to make difficult choices.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. I want to go back to the first Earth Day because I participated. I had a book at the time called Clear, Cleaner, Safer, Greener, A Blueprint for New Environment. And at that time, I was very optimistic that a plant-based diet, locally grown and organic, would make a difference. I was one of the two leading spokesperson for that in the media. The other was Frances Moore LePay, a woman who I have an enormous amount of respect for, the author of Die for Small Planet. In fact, we both had the same publisher, Ballantine Press. I had a book on vegetarianism, and she had hers. And I remember at the time when I was doing a tour, I was down in Dallas, Texas. There was a massive group of people. There were a lot of singers. And when I was talking about the environment and how if we just did one thing, just one thing, if we went from a meat-based diet to a plant-based diet, it would not only make us healthier physically, allowing us to prevent a lot of diseases, but also it would help the environment. And I explained how much water it took to raise the beef to where you could just get 1 pound, a hamburger or a steak, and it was about 1,400 gallons, whereas a pound of potatoes or a pound of beans would take in the neighborhood of about anywhere from 45 to 69 gallons of water. I said, so that's a tremendous difference. When in the future, we're going to see a lot of states that are going to be water deficient. So therefore, a vegetable-based diet would be much healthier for the environment, healthier for them. And I was watching the crowd, and it was as if their eyes had glazed over. Now, at the end of that day, I walked around that giant fairground, and all I saw were massive litters of hamburger wrappers and cola cans and cigarettes and beer bottles. So I had this moment, one of those oh-ah moments, where I realized that they didn't come for my message. They came for the music, to celebrate the music. And then when I was at other movements, including the Rainbow Movement, many others, where you would assume that people would be enlightened enough to be vegan, to respect the environment, again, I didn't see it. So today, with my latest film, Saving the Planet One Bite at a Time, and my latest book on the same topic, but using the science of why we should go plant, we now can say that we have about 1.3% of the American population who are vegan. Probably half of them are younger people who are vegan but not healthy vegan. Like they'll eat a pizza without the pastrami or the cheese and say that they're a vegan, more for consciousness. And then the other half of vegans are probably very conscious and being very, very wise in the choice they're making. But vegetarianism today represents only about 2.5% of the American population. Now think for a moment. Think of all the books, articles, lectures, demonstrations. Think of all the insights, documentaries that have been done since the first Earth Day. Think of all the celebrities from Paul McCartney and Alicia Silverstone and all the others who have promoted vegetarianism, animal rights. So there has not been a deficiency of information and access of quality material on the internet. But we're not changing in mass yet, because 97.5% of the population are still not only eating meat, they're eating more meat, and they're eating more sugar. And we have more diabetes, more heart disease, more cancer, more inflammatory conditions than ever before. And we're more obese than ever before. The United States has about 329 million people, yet we have more obese people than India per population or China per population. You're dealing with 1.3 and 1.3 and a half billion people. So clearly we're not doing it right. What do you think we've missed in the last 30, 40 years? And what is going forward will be new methods of reaching those people so that we have a greater percentage joining the cause?
Well, I think the first thing basically was that in a very false way, it is true that in the West, as people got richer, they ate more meat. And yet they imposed it on the rest of the world. And I've always laughed when I've done seed saving and then I've tried to enter the English name. This year is the year of pulses. Now, pulses are the most miraculous plant proteins. But not only do they give us protein as a very, very good alternative to meat, they also give us nitrogen in the soil without the violence of a fossil fuel agriculture, without having to burn fossil fuels at 500 degrees to fix atmospheric nitrogen. And then when you apply this, part of it goes right back into the atmosphere and makes nitrogen oxide, which is 300 times more deadly as a greenhouse gas. Large part of it runs off and is giving you all the dead zones, gets into the water, gives you the nitrate pollution. We have created a disaster when if we had stuck to a vegetarian diet, we would have made, taken care that our pulses are part of our cropping system. So when I've been saving seeds, I was fascinated that India, which is based on pulses, and pulses for your listeners are basically all the crops that do nitrogen fixing. They include all the beans. Now, if you think of chickpea, which we call chana, well, they called it chickpea, which means it's for chicken. Think of tur, it's called pigeon pea. Think of gehet, it's called horse gram. Every dal, every pulse was given an animal feed name. And I think what's gone so wrong is that the industrial agriculture model brings more profits to turning our precious food into animal feed and pushing more people to eat meat, because that's where the subsidies are. Look at the figures for GMO corn and soya. Always argument, oh, we are feeding the world, world will starve, there'll be 9 million people, and the 9 billion will starve if there's not enough GMOs. What have the GMOs given us? Corn and soya, 90% is going for biofuel, to continue the automobile addiction, and for animal feed to torture animals and then ruin health. It's all happening because huge amounts of our tax money is being used to subsidize these factory farms. Worse, there's an environmental subsidy. If you add up all the destruction in the Amazon, the chopping down of the Amazon forest to grow illegal soya, or destruction of both the ecosystems and the health of the Argentinian people to grow soya. Why have we expanded soya so much for animal feed? And the minute we start turning back to our pulses, we do intercropping in North America. The First Nations called it the Three Sisters. Grow the corn, grow the beans, grow the squash. South of your border, Mexico, they call it milpa. Navdanya, the name stands for nine crops, and I received it literally during a seed collection trip from a tribal who was growing nine crops, and they explained to me the relationship between nine crops in your field, the cosmic balance of the nine planets, and the health of your body. And he said, balance and harmony is one indivisible continuity from the cosmos to the last cell in our bodies. An illiterate tribal taught me this. The poor scientists have long time to catch up within their reductionist and mechanistic framework. And for your listeners, I want to mention that we have brought out a book called The Pulse of Life to celebrate this year's Year of Pulses, United Nations Year of Pulses. It's about all the diversity of plants that can give us good protein, lots of recipes, the explosion of the soya empire, how it's subsidized, how it's based on Monsanto's patent regime and the collection of royalties, and then how this has meant that both the biodiversity of our crops and the diversity in our diet disappears and all of us start to become sick. 75% of the sickness of the earth is coming from that same system of food and agriculture that is responsible for 75% of the human diseases today. So we can get rid of both the sicknesses by turning to a more biodiverse, a more plant-based diet. But that means learning more about what's around us, learning more about what we can grow in a garden and in a terrace, and realizing that we are not separate from nature but part of nature, and the biodiversity is not a luxury to watch in a wilderness park, but biodiversity is what makes life, and it is our food.
During the past 4 to 6 months, I feel we're witnessing a gradual grassroots awakening around the world, and this appears to be having an impact and blowback upon the corporate elite and the globalists and the national governments. There have been some very important losses for Monsanto, particularly rulings against the safety of Roundup and GMO labeling efforts. People in developing countries, particularly the U.S. and U.K., France, Germany, and Australia, are losing complete trust in their governments and their politicians. So there is positive momentum leaning towards systemic change. I'd like to hear your analysis of what you perceive as the emerging democratic movement. And what would you recommend as the next steps these movements need to make in order to further what you call Earth democracy?
Well, I so agree with you that there is an absolute explosion of people seeking a deep democracy. Otherwise, why would such large numbers be coming out for Bernie Sanders' rally in your country? Why would the young people be seeing hope there? And why would the disillusioned unemployed workers see hope in hate and fear and racism? What we are witnessing is a rapid emergence of a convergence of consciousness. I think for the last 30 years, we used to look at one thing at a time. There were environmentalists, and there were economic justice people, and then there were social justice people, and then there were gender justice people, and then there were racial justice people. And each of them had their little area in which to work. I think the young people are realizing that they are part of the 99%. After all, the Occupy movement gave that name. And to be part of the 99% means you've got to create a new way of living on this planet. Second, most of them are deeply aware of the ecological crisis. And they don't want to continue to be part of the problem. They want to be part of the solution. And I think the third very big issue is they really want to participate. They want their freedom of a deep kind, not the fake kind of the neoliberal freedom of grab what you can if you're powerful, but the deep kind, that your freedom and the freedom of your neighbor, your freedom and the freedom of the next species is all one freedom. And the creativity of this interconnected freedom, in that quotation from Isho Upanishad, and then the Gandhi interpretation of the earth as enough for everyone's needs, is where the young people are turning to. What can we do? I think in my country, I work with people. Just the other day, I was in an area where 120 million liters of river water was to be stolen by three factories. And the government was giving 3 trillion rupees of a subsidy to build the long-distance pipelines to steal the water. So when the people came to me, so what do we do? I said, just do what Gandhi did. Don't let the water go. Just tell the government we won't let this river be killed. We won't let our water be stolen. Our water is a commons. So this kind of protection, which is exactly what we practice with the seed satyagraha, defending our seeds and saying, we don't care what laws you write. You can cook up patent laws, we won't recognize them because we recognize ourselves as part of the earth family. You can try and criminalize seed saving as they are doing in the US, where seed libraries are being told that there's a risk of agro-terrorism if 5 varieties of seeds are in a public library. Notices are being served. California has passed a law making it illegal to exchange seed beyond a 3-mile radius. All of this is a desperate move to criminalize freedom of nature, of people. This is where Satyagraha Gandhi's force of truth comes in. For those who already live in industrial and market economy, I think the challenge is to shape local economies. What you were saying at the first Earth Day, local economies is the only way people will have work. The young people will not be unemployed. Local economies is the only way we'll build solidarity and security for each other. Otherwise, we are going to see more and more Syrians. We're going to see more and more Nigerians, as the earth is exploited so much that she's not able to support human life and societies, and societies then disintegrate through violence. Very, very carefully, we have to cultivate nonviolence. Very carefully, we have to realize that taking care of the earth and being part of earth community is also being part of one humanity. And that's why we undertook a pact at the climate summit to say we are part of one earth and one humanity, we're going to protect both. And because there are criminal corporations, lying, stealing, buying governments, corrupting politicians, putting politicians in power, and worst in the food sector in the last 20 years, has been Monsanto. So on Earth Day this year, 15th and 16th of October, we are putting Monsanto on public trial, both in The Hague as a people-organized tribunal, a Monsanto tribunal, but I am calling everyone, look at the harm done, call Monsanto to account, but also take a resolve to shape a food system that's good for the earth, that's good for yourself, and good for your community. Let us make Earth Day this year the turning point and realize that the future is in our hands to cultivate with love.
I appreciate that insight. Just one more question. Since our economic system and globalization and national and international structures of governments are distinctly patriarchal, rarely is any thought given to the fact that natural resource scarcity and the adverse effects of anthropogenic climate change affect women first. This is especially true in the developing countries. In developed countries, this goes more unnoticed because women in the West largely have been usurped into the capitalist system and don't bear the weight of community survival as much as the women in poorer nations. They're also most likely to be victimized by economic and natural catastrophes. At the same time, women are usually the last voices to be heard about how to combat these threats to both the future of humanity and the preservation of other life forms in the planet itself. I'd like to hear you put forth the case of globalization, capitalization run amok, and the climate crisis that globalization and free market trades rules and the corporate depletion of essential resources is bringing upon us are all part of a regime that undermines the roles of women throughout the world. And then if we regard the world's women as the protectors of the planet's natural economy, how does the dominant trade economy undermine or destroy this natural economy? And what are we to do in the long term to stop this?
First, Gary, to deal with all of this, we actually built a movement called Diverse Women for Diversity. Because the patriarchal model of global control over resources and markets is based on monocultures and monopolies. And so we created Diverse Women for Diversity. And it is both women of the North and the South who realize that this war against the earth is also a war against women. Look at how violence against women has grown as the globalization project of objectification and commodification has grown. And because the corporation is the ultimate patriarchal construction, that patriarchal construction appropriates the knowledge of women, the rights of women, and marginalizes them further. What is the alternative? The alternative is to recognize women's creativity, to recognize how women are the first producers. And in fact, they're more efficient producers because they don't have the luxury of waste. So in Nigeria, on 2% land, women produce 50% of the food. Our studies are showing that the small, diverse farm looked after by women can produce two times the food humanity needs because they take care of biodiversity. The movements we built, as well as our research, is showing that this thing called golden rice, where they want to put some vitamin A into rice, it is hundreds of percent less efficient than the crops women grow. And we just need more land in women's hands, more seeds in women's hands, and more access to markets for women. Take this other one, an insanity of a GMO banana, and the claim is it will prevent women from dying in childbirth because they will increase iron fivefold. Now, iron isn't the smartest source of bananas. It is a very good source of other nutrients. The iron is 0.44 milligrams. They increase it five times, it will be 2. The turmeric, 64. The tamarind, similar. Just touch the foods we use, 7,000% more efficient. And it's diversity and multifunctionality and nonviolence and care and sharing. Those are the typical values in the economies women shape. What we need to do is make the entire economy based on those values, not on the patriarchal values of assuming that the strongest person is the one who crushes others and pushes others to extinction. The strongest is the one who's the most greedy and appropriates others' share. No, that is blindness, it's greed, it's irresponsibility. And today we do have a model in the forms of the economy through which women have sustained humanity and protected the earth to make that the basis of our local economies, our earth economies. And as I've written in Staying Alive, what we need to do is move from economies that kill to living economies that nourish, from democracies that are dead and fake to living democracies where everyone participates, and cultures of hate to living cultures that embrace all life on earth and all humanity as one in undivided family.
Well said. Vandana, thank you very much for being on today.
Welcome.
On a special Earth Day program. Author of a very important work called Staying Alive, Women, Ecology, and Development. Her website is vandanashiva.com or NAVDANYA.org.
Happy Earth Day, Gary. Bye-bye.
Bye. Now let us immediately go over to our next guest, who is in Northern California, Derek Jensen. Derek has become one of the nation's leading voices of cultural and environmental dissent. He writes on how civilization is devastating the environment and the natural world, and our society's denial of that fact. Hotney Reader listed Derek among the 50 visionaries changing the world, in sharp contrast to environmental optimists who believe working within the corporate system will offset the tenuous planetary balance threatened by climate change. Derek has advocated for many years a dismantling of the civilization, which can include radical dissent as well as imparting wisdom to our children. And Derek has written many books, including The Derek Jensen Reader, Writing on Environmental Revolution, and his forthcoming The Myth of Human Supremacy, which will release next month. He also hosts a weekly radio program, Resistance Radio, on the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. His website is Derek, D-E-R-R-I-C-K, Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, .org. Nice to have you with us today, Derek.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Derek, I invited you because you represent an important critique to a philosophy that permeates our civilization's high regard for the place or status humanity holds for the universe. And I believe that Dr. Shiva's response and contribution to this dialogue has produced some insights that are extremely important for our listeners to hear. Today, fundamentalism is rampant. And this is not simply religious fundamentalism, but also scientific fundamentalism, such as with GMOs, nuclear power, vaccines, economic free market fundamentalism, even democratic fundamentalism, as an ideology the U.S. government would like to export throughout the world. And what they all seem to have in common is a human, or more appropriately, man-made ideology or apparatus that regards itself as superior to natural law. It may exploit natural laws, but it does so within humanity's own narcissistic image of itself. And the result of this hubris of human superiority and ingenuity is that it prides itself in being wiser than our natural world, and has created a financial and industrial complex that now threatens all life on this planet. So please take your time and explain this belief of humanity holds about there being a hierarchy of nature and human comprising the apex of this pyramid. And then what have been the consequences of this belief? And then Vandana talked about providing insights that challenges our current sense of democracy and going towards an earth democracy. I'd like your input on that too. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Well, I think one of the most destructive ideas that humans have ever come up with is something called the Great Chain of Being, and it's a hierarchy of perfection that starts with God, and then below God are the angels, and then below the angels is the king, and then below the king is either the queen or the male lords, you know, and then you work your way down to commoner males and then commoner females, and then you have various animals. Below that is plants, and then below that is soil, and below that is, I think, sand or something. And the point is that those at the top are pure mind, and those at the bottom are pure body, and those at the top are superior to those at the bottom. And it has been used to rationalize, I mean, it rationalized the divine right of kings, and it rationalized that that's why the king was closer to God. That's why everybody had to listen to him. And it's obviously very self-serving for those in power. And this notion, you know, we can say, well, that's obviously a silly notion, but we still believe it very profoundly in this idea that humans are superior to and separate from everyone else on the planet. And this notion that humans are the only ones who think, and humans are the only ones who communicate. And this is, I'm going to jump to a different direction for a moment. There's a line that somebody says to me in an interview I did, gosh, this was 20-some years ago, where he was talking about how science is becoming increasingly sensitive. The ability to measure is becoming increasingly sensitive. And he said, only for so long will we be able to ignore the fact that science is making tools that show that non-humans can communicate and are communicating everywhere. And so we're facing there's a pretty huge crisis going on that a lot of people aren't aware of, that a crisis of an existential crisis that we're learning, for example, that plants communicate, that fungus are intelligent, that plants are intelligent, and that plants... We have this belief that humans are special and that humans are the only ones with language, but it ends up prairie dogs have language, they've got grammar, chickens have language and grammar, bonobos...
Whales, porpoises, dogs and cats, primates of all types?
Basically everybody.
They all communicate, yes.
They communicate, and it ends up that they at this point have done experiments with slime molds that they can... If you put a slime mold in a maze and it will grow randomly around the maze to some food, but then if you take off a little piece of the slime mold, put it in the maze again, it has learned and it will go directly to the food. And plants, it ends up that if a caterpillar is chewing on a leaf, then that plant will send out messages to other plants saying, you need to change the composition of your leaves to make it so they're not palatable or they're toxic to this type of caterpillar. And it will work across species many times. But then you'll hear arguments back that people will say, oh, but there's no nervous system for plants, which means that they're obviously not feeling distress and they're obviously not able to communicate because you need to have a nervous system in order to communicate. But that is simply projecting that the idea that in order to be intelligent, you have to have a nervous system like a human. There's this idea that other intelligences have to replicate ours. But the truth is that there's this guy Stefano Mancuso who's doing great work on plant intelligence, and he's assembling a dictionary basically of the different language that plants speak. And the way plants will communicate with each other, they don't speak using vocal cords like we do, obviously. Instead, they will send out pheromones. And I'm sure a lot of people have experienced this. I experienced this once when I lived in Spokane. I had this tree that was being covered with aphids. It had a huge aphid infestation. I didn't know what to do, so I didn't do anything. The leaves were dropping, everything else. And then about, maybe a week later, thousands and thousands of ladybugs showed up. And the reason they showed up is because the tree was sending out distress signals, saying, or you could say it was sending out, hey, come have a buffet signals, whatever. I don't know what it was sending out, but it was sending out chemical messages that were perceived by the ladybug. So they're actually doing interspecies communication with that too, and they're communicating with other trees saying, hey, there's aphids here. You need to change the composition of your leaves. This happens everywhere, and there's this. But the point I'm getting at is there, okay, I'm going to back up again and say that there's this idea that because we are superior, we get to do whatever we want to the planet, which is a crazy notion in the first place. This superiority is always based on notions that are tautological. And a tautology is something where the definition is the same as your conclusion. So if we say, what is a square is a thing that looks like a square. That's a tautological definition. And all of our definitions of how humans are superior are all tautological, and they set humans up as a standard, and then once humans are the standard, then we judge ourselves to be superior by those standards. A great example is we think humans are superior because we have big brains, and that's great because humans have big brains, therefore big brains are a sign of intelligence, and therefore we're the most intelligent. But there's a problem with this, which is that, of course, whales have much bigger brains than we do, and elephants have much bigger brains than we do, and walruses are about the same size brain. So then what they do is they immediately change the rules and say, well, okay, so the sign of intelligence is not large brain size, but instead it is brain size to body mass ratio. And there's a problem with that, too, which is humans have a brain size to body mass ratio of about 2.5%. That's the same as it is for mice. Songbirds actually have about an 8.5% or 7.5% brain size to body mass ratio, and shrews have about a 10% brain size to body mass ratio. And the point is that immediately then the people who are talking about this will say, well, obviously brain size to body mass ratio doesn't work because, of course, we're not number one. Or we will say humans are intelligent because we invent cars. Well, you're making the invention of cars as the standard of intelligence. Well, that, of course, we're going to win because we're the ones who make cars. And this gets even more and more absurd because Elon Musk has talked about how we want to find alien intelligence, which is just completely... I'll back up again. And somebody asked an astronomer a few years ago why we have to explore Mars. His answer was to answer that most important question of all, are we all alone? And that's where this leads us, is to destroying this planet and searching for life elsewhere, when this planet is so full of life. It's just, it's completely crazy, but we don't recognize it. Because we don't recognize it, we end up desperately lonely, and we end up rationalizing. The whole point of this superiority is to rationalize our ability to exploit. And I want to talk about Elon Musk for just a moment, and then I'll stop, and you can ask me another question. But Elon Musk was talking about how when we are searching for life on other planets, that one thing to search for is atmospheric pollution. Because if you have atmospheric pollution, that means you have signs of industrialism, which means you have signs of intelligence. And so what he's doing is he's actually conflating poisoning the planet with intelligence. And all of this is really crucial, because if you perceive the destruction of a planet as a sign of your intelligence, that you are actually perceiving your destructive activities.
We'd be pretty stupid.
As a sign of your superiority. That's just nuts. That's rewarding the wrong sort of behavior.
Well, I think we've done that for a long time. Hence, we meet, we grow, we tear down rainforest in order to plant seeds or to graze cattle, and those soybeans are then fed to cattle. Then that causes heart disease and cancer and diabetes and obesity. So it seems like we don't care about communicating with any creatures or nature. We're nature devoid. We're nature depleted. We're destroying natural habitats. So I think we're well past that that stop sign that should have us stop and say, do we really think there's intelligent life on a planet that would destroy its own planet by its intelligence? You don't destroy something with your intelligence. You are living out of balance. So the issue then for me, Derek, is the majority of people have yet to be shaken from their stupor to either perceive anything is wrong with our industrialized civilization and our diet and our way of life and our work habits and our form of commercial democracy. And this has led to various degrees of climate change denialism. And I think it's difficult for most Western people to wrap their minds around the possibility that our entire system of governance, our views of capital and resources, our views of human nature, of each other, our views or lack of view of the sacredness of life, and as you mentioned, the interconnectivity, the inner capacity to communicate in whatever way they choose, pheromones, as you mentioned, with a tree, or humans with our vocal cords, or in some other level of vibrations, that we stay away from all that because it's of no interest. We stay completely immersed in entertaining ourselves, and of course, in the process of entertaining ourselves, we're distracting ourselves and marching towards a catastrophic collapse and possibly species annihilation. So in your travels and lectures and experiences, what do you find to be the greatest naivety held, also the held erroneous myths and obstacles people embrace and cherish that prevent them from shaking themselves out of their trance and becoming more aware of the dangers ahead? And if you could share that, and that'll be our final thought for this Earth Day program.
Well, I think that there's a line that has deeply influenced me, which is by Upton Sinclair, which is, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would alter that line a little bit to, it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it. And I think that we are, to go once again a different direction with this, Lewis Mumford talked about how he asked the question back in the 60s, how is it that we have all surrendered so much to the authoritarians, to those in power? How is it that we all recognize that, you know, democracy is a sham, and that this whole system is just based on increasing power for a very few at the expense of life on the planet? And he said part of the answer is that this particular system has a brilliant development over the what he called half-baked authoritarian systems of the Roman era or before, and that's that this system tries to give enough of the goodies of the system to enough of the population to buy them off. And he called this a magnificent bribe, and that basically, so long as he said what the system will do is to grant you everything the system makes, and all of these, you know, access to ice cream 24/7 and access to television, access to all these particular goodies to a certain percentage of you, and here's what you must do, is if you accept that bribe, then you must never ask for anything that the system cannot give you. And I think that is a completely brilliant analysis on his part, and that's one of the reasons that so many of us become so incredibly stupid, is because if we actually recognize the horror of the system, then that means that we will lose access to our refrigerators, to the various goodies that the system has given us. After Fukushima, one of the Japanese energy ministers said the reason they have to continue with nuclear energy is because no one can imagine living without electricity. Well, I got news for you, which is we were living without electricity very well until about 120 years ago, and we covered basically every continent but Antarctica with it. And most humans on the planet right now are still living without electricity, and many of them are doing very well. And there's another point to be made here, which is, please notice he said, no one can imagine living without electricity, but he didn't say no one can imagine living without polar bears. He didn't say no one can imagine living without coral reefs. And that's the problem, is we have been bought into this system where no one can imagine living without cars, living without all the things that the system gives you, but we can very well try to imagine living without phytoplankton. And that's, of course, completely insane, because phytoplankton keeps us alive, and the real world is what keeps us alive. But we have, our imagination has been completely subsumed into this system. One more thing real quick, which is, there was a New York Times editorial maybe a year ago where they talked about the difficult decisions that are made by environmentalists around the world and people trying to save biodiversity. And they were saying it's just so terrible because we have to make, it was the thing was called an ark for the Anthropocene. And they were saying it's so difficult choosing which animals to save and which ones to drive extinct. And they were talking about criteria that people would choose for which creatures to save. And the thing that broke my, well, there are many things broke my heart about this article, but one of them was that through all of this, they're discussing just blithely getting rid of great cats, getting rid of great apes, getting rid of great classes, getting rid of amphibians. They're talking about that blithely, but what nobody is mentioning is there was not a single mention of the possibility of losing any technologies. They didn't say, oh, let's get rid of internet. Let's get rid of internet pornography, for that matter, so that the great swaths of this planet can be sacrificed on the altar of industrial civilization. But there was no consideration of losing any of our goodies. And that's
Gary,
completely insane.
Brilliant final thought. Thank you very much. Derek Jensen from out Northern California. And you can hear Derek's show on the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Appreciate you being on, Derek. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I want to thank all of you from all over the world for listening today on Earth Day, a special, Conversations with Remarkable Minds, a dialogue on the myth of human privilege and our disconnection from that natural world. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Face again.